might mean six, and we just don't have room in our life for six children. I mean, do we? As I run out of steam, I realise that Dan is also talking, just as urgently, straight across me, as though he's jumped into a swimming pool too. Look at the finances, he's saying. I mean, what about university fees? What about the extra bedroom? What about the car? Hang on a minute. What are you saying? I peer at him, puzzled. I'm sorry, Sylvie. He looks at me tensely. I know we got carried away last night. And maybe you want a bigger family, which is something we'll have to talk through. And I'll always respect your views, I'm just saying. I don't want a big family, I cut across him. You're the one that wants six children. Six? He gapes at me. Are you nuts? We had one unprotected shag. Where did six children come from? Honestly, can't you see? It's so obvious. We have another one, and then we go for a fourth, so the baby has a friend, and get landed with triplets, I explain. It happens. That family in Stoke Newington, I remind him. At the word triplets, Dan looks utterly aghast. His eyes meet mine, and I can see the truth in them. He doesn't want triplets. He doesn't want a minivan. He doesn't want any of this. I think another baby is a red herring, he says at last. It's not the answer to anything. I think we were both quite pissed last night. I bite my lip. We really shouldn't be in charge of our own reproductive systems. I cast my mind back to the little duckling sleep suit. Last night I felt so broody. I desperately wanted a brand new baby inside it. Now I want to fold it up and put it away. How can I have changed my mind like that? What about the duckling sleep suit? I press Dan, just to make sure he's not concealing some deep, buried desire, which he'll then reveal in some torrent of resentment when it's all too late and we're a faded elderly couple staying by a lake in Italy, wondering where our lives went wrong. We just did an Anita Bruckner novel in our book club. It's a sleep suit, he shrugs. End of. And what about the next 68 years? I remind him. What about the empty, interminable decades ahead of us? There's silence. Then Dan looks up at me with a wry smile. Well, like the doctor said, he shrugs, there are always box sets. Box sets? I think we can do better than bloody box sets. As I arrive at the bell for the quiz that evening, I feel fired up on all cylinders. I'm pumping with adrenaline, almost seething, which, to be fair, is due to all sorts of things, not just dealing with how to be married to Dan forever. And then some. Mostly it's my day at work which has got me agitated. I don't know what's happened at Willoughby House. No, scratch that. I know exactly what's happened. The evil nephew has happened. I suppose what I mean is, I don't know what he said to Mrs. Kendrick, because she's transformed overnight, and not for the better. Mrs. Kendrick used to be the standard bearer. She was the fixed measure for what was right, according to her. She just knew. She had her way, and she never doubted it, ever, and we all abided by it. But now her iron rod is wavering. She seems jumpy and anxious, unsure of all her principles. For about half an hour this morning, she went wandering around the office, as though seeing it through fresh eyes. She picked up the box and looked at it, as though suddenly dissatisfied with it. She put some old editions of Country Life in recycling. She got them back out again later, I saw her. She gazed longingly at the fax machine for a bit. Then she turned away, approached the computer, and said in hopeful tones, "A computer is very like a fax machine, isn't it, Sylvie?" I reassured her that yes, a computer was in many ways like a fax machine, in that it was a great way to communicate with people. But that was a huge mistake, because she sat down and said, "I think I'll do some emails," with an air of bravado, and tried to swipe the screen like an iPad. So I broke off what I was doing and went to help her, and after a few minutes, when Mrs. Kendrick tetchily said, "Sylvie, dear, you're not making any sense," Clarissa joined in too. Oh my God. It eventually turned out, after a lot of frustration and bewilderment on everyone's part, that Mrs. Kendrick had been under the impression that the subject line was the email, I had to explain that you open each email up and read the contents. Whereupon she gazed in astonishment and said, "Oh, I see." Then, when I closed each email down, she gasped and said, "Where's it gone?" about 20 times. She was getting a bit hassled by then, so I made her a nice cup of tea and showed her a letter of appreciation that had come in from a supporter, on paper, written in ink pen. That made her happy. And I know her nephews probably said to her, "Get with the program, Aunt Margaret, and start using email." But what I would retort is, "For God's sake, let her send faxes to all her friends. What's wrong with that?" He's coming in again soon to assess things. Well, two can play at assessing. And if I assess that he's freaking his aunt out for no good reason, I'll be letting him know, believe me. Probably in a nice, polite email after he's left. I'm not brilliant at confrontation, truth be told. I give my hair a quick smooth down, then venture into the pub, already deciding that this was a terrible idea, that there's not much I can do about it now. The place has been transformed for the evening, with a glittery banner reading Royal Trinity Hospice Quiz, and a little stage in the corner with a PA system. Groups of people are already sitting with glasses of wine and pints, peering at sheets of paper. I see Simon and Olivia sitting with Tilda and Toby and head to the table, giving everyone a kiss. "Dan's on his way," I say, pulling out a chair. "Just waiting for the babysitter." What with the cost of babysitting, plus tickets and booze, tonight has worked out pretty expensive for an evening we're both dreading. As I was leaving home, Dan actually said, "Why the hell didn't we just send along a 50-quid donation? Stay at home and watch Veep." But I don't divulge this to the others. I'm trying to be positive. "Won't this be fun?" I add brightly. "Absolutely," says Olivia at once. "You can't take these things too seriously. We're just here for the fun of it." I don't know Simon and Olivia very well. They're about Tilda's age and have children at college. He's avuncular and jolly, with curly hair and specs, but she's quite intense and twitchy. She always seems to be clenching her hands, with her knuckles straining at her white skin, and she has this disconcerting way of looking away mid-conversation, with a sudden swooping, ducking gesture of her head, as though she thinks you're about to hit her. The gossip is that they nearly divorced last year because Simon had an affair with his assistant, and Olivia made him go away for a week's marriage therapy in the Cotswolds, and they had to light candles and brush away his infidelity with special mystic twig brooms. That's according to Toby, who heard it from their neighbour's au pair. Although, obviously, I don't listen to gossip, nor imagine the pair of them brushing away his infidelity with twig brooms every time I see them. Believe me, if it was Dan's infidelity, I'd want to do a lot more than brush it away with a twig broom. Thrash it with a mallet, maybe. "What's your specialist subject, Sylvie?" demands Tilda as I sit down. "I've been boning up on capital cities." "No," I say, "capitals are my thing." "Capital of Latvia," rejoins Tilda, passing me a glass of wine. My mind jumps about with a little spark of optimism. Do I know this? Latvia. Budapest. No, that's Prague. I mean, Hungary. "Okay, capital cities can be your thing," I allow, generously. "I'll focus on art history." "Good. And Simon knows all about football." "Last year, we would have won if we'd played our joker on the football round," Olivia suddenly puts in. "But Simon insisted on using it too early." She regards Simon with stony eyes, and I exchange glances with Tilda. Olivia is so not here for the fun of it. "Our team is called the Canville Conquerors," Tilda tells me, "because of living on Canville Road." "Very good." I take a gulp of wine and am about to regale Tilda with my day at the office when Olivia leans forward. "Sylvie, look at these famous landmarks." She pushes a sheet of paper toward me. On it are about 20 grainy photocopied photos. "Can you name any of them? This is the first round." I peer at the sheet with a frown. It's so badly reproduced I can't even see what anything is, let alone the Eiffel Tower, I say, suddenly spotting it. "Everyone's got the Eiffel Tower," says Olivia impatiently. "Look, we've already written it in. Eiffel Tower. Can't you get any others? I peer vaguely at the sheet, passing over Stonehenge and Ayers Rock, which have also been written on. Is that the Chrysler Building? No, snaps Olivia. It just looks a bit like the Chrysler Building, but it isn't actually it. Okay, I say humbly. I'm already feeling a bit hysterical. I don't know anything, nor does Tilda, and Olivia is looking more and more like a headmistress with pursed lips. Suddenly she sits bolt upright and nudges Simon. Who are they? A team of guys in matching purple polo shirts walks in and sits down. Half of them have beards, and most of them have glasses, and all of them look fearsomely bright. Shall we not do the quiz? I say to Tilda, only half joking. Shall we just be spectators? Welcome, everyone, welcome. A middle-aged guy with a mustache mounts the tiny platform and speaks into the microphone. I'm Dave, and I'm your quiz master tonight. I've never done this before. I've stepped in because Nigel's ill, so go easy on me. He gives an awkward half-laugh, then clears his throat. So, let's play fair. Let's have some fun. Please switch off your phones. He looks around severely. No Googling, no texting a friend. Vere Bolton. Toby! Tilda gives him a nudge. Off! Toby blinks at her and puts his phone away. He's trimmed his hipster beard, I notice. Excellent. Now he just needs to get rid of his million grotty leather bracelets. Hey, that's Iguazu National Park, he says suddenly, pointing at one of the grainy pictures. I've been there. Shh, says Olivia, looking livid. Be discreet. Don't yell it out for the whole room to hear. I hear someone at the next table say, Put Iguazu National Park. And Olivia practically explodes in rage. You see, she says to Toby, they heard. If you know an answer, write it down. She jabs furiously at the paper. Write it. I'm getting some crisps, says Toby without acknowledging Olivia at all. As he gets up, I shoot Tilda a collusive grin, but she doesn't return it. That boy, she says. She presses her hands against her cheeks hard, then blows out. What am I going to do with him? You won't guess his latest. Never. What's he done now? Empty pizza boxes. He's been keeping them in the airing cupboard, can you believe? The airing cupboard! With our clean sheets! Tilda's face is so pink and indignant, I want to laugh. But somehow I keep a straight face. That's not good, I say. You're right, she says hotly. It's not. I started to smell herbs every time I opened the airing cupboard, like oregano. I thought, well, it must be our new fabric conditioner. But today, it started to smell rancid and quite vile, so I investigated further, and what did I find? Pizza boxes? I venture. Exactly! Pizza boxes! She fixes a reproachful gaze on Toby, who sits down and dumps three packets of crisps on the table. He was disposing of them in the airing cupboard because he couldn't be bothered to go downstairs. I was not disposing of them, Toby responds laconically. Mum, I've explained this to you. It was a holding system. I was going to take them to recycling. No, you weren't. Of course I was. He gives her a rancorous glare. I just hadn't taken them yet. Well, even if it was a holding system. You can't have a holding system for pizza boxes in an airing cupboard. Tilda's voice pitches upward in outrage. An airing cupboard! So, on with the space and time round. Dave's chirpy tones boom through the microphone. And the first question is, who was the third man on the moon? I repeat, who was the third man on the moon? There's a rustling and muttering throughout the room. Anyone? Says Olivia, looking round the table. The third man on the moon? I pull a face at Tilda. Not Neil Armstrong, Tilda counts briskly off on her fingers. Not Buzz Aldrin. We all look at one another blankly. Around the room I can hear about 20 people whispering to each other. Not Neil Armstrong. We know it wasn't them, snaps Olivia. Who was it? Toby, You're into maths and science. Do you know? The moon landings were faked, so the question's invalid, says Toby without missing a beat, and Tilda emits an exasperated squeak. They were not faked. Ignore him, Olivia. You can live in denial if you like, Toby shrugs. Live in your bubble, believe the lies. Why do you think they were faked? I ask curiously, and Tilda shakes her head at me. Don't get him started, she says. He's got a conspiracy theory about everything. Lip balm, Paul McCartney. Lip balm? I stare at her. Lip balm causes your lips to crack, says Toby dispassionately. It's addictive. It's designed to make you buy more. You use lip balm, Sylvie. Big Pharma's using you like a puppet. He shrugs again and I gaze back, feeling a bit unnerved. I always have lip balm in my bag. And Paul McCartney? I can't help asking. Died in 1966, Toby says, succinctly. Replaced by a lookalike. There are clues in Beatles songs everywhere, if you know where to look for them. You see, Tilda appeals to me. You see what I have to live with. Pizza boxes, conspiracy theories, everything in the house rewired. It wasn't rewired, says Toby patiently. It was rerouted. Question two, says Dave into the microphone. Harrison Ford played Han Solo in Star Wars. But what character did he play in the 1985 film Witness? He was the Amish chap, says Simon, coming to life and tapping his pen thoughtfully on his fingers. Oh, wait, he wasn't Amish. The girl was Amish. Oh, God, Olivia gives a groan. That film is ancient. Does anyone remember it? She turns to Toby. It was before your time, Toby. It's about... What's it about? She wrinkles her brow. The Witness Protection Scheme. Something like that. The Witness Protection Scheme, echoes Toby, sardonically, doing quote marks with his fingers. Toby, do not start about the Witness Protection Scheme, says Tilda ominously. Do not start. What? I say, my curiosity fired up. Don't tell me you have a conspiracy theory about the Witness Protection Scheme too. Does anyone know the answer to the actual question? Olivia demands crossly, but none of us is paying attention. You want to know? Toby turns his gaze on me. Yes, tell me. If they ever offer you a place in the Witness Protection Scheme, run for your life, says Toby, without batting an eyelid, because they're going to get rid of you. What do you mean? I demand. Who is? The government kills everyone in the Witness Protection Scheme. He shrugs yet again. It makes economic sense. Kills them. They could never afford to protect that number of people. He does his little quotey fingers again. It's a myth. A fairy tale. They get rid of them instead. But they can't just get rid of people. Their families would... I stop midstream. Oh. You see? He raises his eyebrows at me significantly. Either way, they disappear forever. Who knows the difference? Absolute nonsense, snaps Tilda. You spend far too much time on the internet, Toby. I'm off to the loo. As she pushes her chair back, I fold my arms and survey Toby. You don't really believe all this rubbish, surely. You're just winding up your mum. Maybe, he winks. Or maybe not. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean there isn't a conspiracy against you. Hey, do your girls like origami? He pulls a piece of paper toward him and starts folding it swiftly. A moment later, he's created a bird. And I gasp. Amazing. Give it to Anna. Here's one for Tessa. He's making a cat now, with little pointed ears. Tell them they're from Tobes. He flashes me a sudden smile, and I feel a pang of affection for him. I've known Toby since he was a teenager in a school uniform and used to lug a trombone to school every morning. Harrison Ford! Olivia bangs the table to get our attention. Concentrate, everyone! What character did he play? Actually, I've just seen Dan arriving. I get to my feet desperate to escape. I'll just go and, back in a second. Okay, I'm never doing a pub quiz again. Ever. They're pure evil sent from Satan. There's a conspiracy theory for you. It's nearly 2 hours later. We've had about 100 more rounds, it feels like. And now we're finally on to the answers. Everyone's getting very tired and bored. But proceedings have stalled because a row has broken out. The question was, how do you spell Rachmaninoff? And some Russian girl at another table wrote it down in Cyrillic. Now Dave is trying to manage a dispute between her and the purple polo shirt team, who are arguing. If no one else in the room understands Cyrillic, how can anyone judge if she's right or not? I mean, for God's sake, what does it matter? Give her the point, give her 10 points, whatever. Let's just move on. It's not only our marriage which is going to last forever. This quiz is going to last forever. We're going to be trapped at this table for eternity, drinking terrible Chardonnay and trying to remember who won Wimbledon in 2008. Until our hair goes white and we shrivel up like Miss Havisham. By the way, Sylvie, I saw a piece about your father in the local paper, says Simon in an undertone. About his fundraising achievements, you must be very proud. I am, I beam gratefully at him. I'm very proud. My father spent a lot of time fundraising for liver cancer. It was his big thing. And being Daddy the super networker, he did it spectacularly. He launched an annual ball at the Dorchester and managed to corral a load of celebrities into coming along and even got minor royalty involved. It said they're naming a scanner suite at the new London hospital after him. They are, I nod. It's amazing. They're putting on this big opening ceremony in a couple of weeks. Sinead Brooke is unveiling the plaque. You know, the newsreader. It's such an honour. I'm making a speech, actually. I must finish writing it, it occurs to me. I keep talking confidently about the speech I'm going to make, but all I've written so far is, My Lady Mayoress, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to what is a very special occasion. Well, it sounds like he was pretty amazing, says Simon. To raise all that money, mobilise people year after year. He also climbed Everest, twice, I nod eagerly. And he competed in the Fastnet sailing race. He raised loads doing that. Wow, impressive, Simon raises his eyebrows. His best friend from school died of liver cancer, I say simply. He always wanted to do something for people with that disease. No one at his company was allowed to raise funds for anything else. I laugh as though I'm joking, although it's not really a joke. Daddy could be quite, what's the word? Intransigent. Like the time I suggested cutting my hair, aged 13. He got angry that I'd even suggested it. He kept saying, Your hair is your glory, Sylvie. Your glory! And actually, he was right. I would have regretted it, probably. Instinctively, I run a hand through my long blonde waves. I could never cut it now. I'd feel like I was betraying him. You must miss him, says Simon. I do. I really do. I can feel tears brightening my eyes, but manage to keep my smile going. I take a sip of wine, then I can't help glancing over at Dan. Sure enough, he's looking tentery. His jaw has tightened. There are frown lines on his brow. I can tell he's waiting for the conversation about my father to pass, like you might wait for a cloud to move. For God's sake, is he that insecure? The thought shoots through my brain before I can stop it, which I know is unfair. My father was always so high octane, so impressive. It must be hard if you're his son-in-law and keep hearing people raving about him. And you're just... No, stop. I don't mean just. Dan isn't just anything. But compared to Daddy... Okay, let's be absolutely honest. Here in the privacy of my own mind, where no one else can hear, I can say it. To the outside world, Dan isn't in the same league as my father. He doesn't have the gloss, the money, the stature, the charitable achievements. And I don't want him to be. I love Dan exactly as he is. I really do. But could he just once acknowledge that my father did have these amazing qualities and realize that this fact doesn't threaten him? He reacts like clockwork every time. And now that the subject is safely passed, I know he'll relax and lean back in his chair and stretch up with his arms and make that little yawning, yelping sound. I watch in slight disbelief as Dan does exactly that. Then he sips his wine just like I knew he would. Then he reaches for a peanut just like I knew he would. Earlier on, he ordered a lamb burger for supper, just like I knew he would. He asked them to hold the mayo, just like I knew he would, and joked with the barman. Is it genuine London lamb? Just like I knew he would. Okay, I'm scaring myself here. I may not know the capital of Latvia, or how many feet there are in a fathom, but I know everything about Dan. I know what he thinks, and what he cares about, and what his habits are. I even know what he's about to do next, right here, sitting in this pub. He's going to ask Toby about his work, which he does every time we see him. I know it, I know it, I know it. So, Toby, says Dan pleasantly, how's the start-up going? Oh, oh my God, I'm omniscient. Something weird is happening in my head. I don't know if it's the Chardonnay or this bloody torturous quiz or my unsettling day, but I'm losing my grip on reality. It's as though the chatter and laughter of the pub are receding. The lights are dimming. I'm staring at Dan with a kind of tunnel vision, a realization, an epiphany. We know too much. This is the problem. This is the issue. I know everything about my husband, everything. I can read his mind. I can predict him. I can order food for him. I have shorthand conversations with him, and never once does he have to ask. What do you mean by that? He already knows. We're living in marital Groundhog Day. No wonder we can't face our endless, monotonous future together. Who wants 68 more years with someone who always puts his shoes back in the same place night after night after night? Actually, I'm not sure what else he would do with his shoes. I certainly don't want him leaving them all over the place. So that's maybe not the best example, but anyway, the point still stands. I take a swig of Chardonnay, my mind swirling around to a conclusion, because it's actually rather easy. We need surprises. That's what we need. Surprises. We need to be jolted and entertained and challenged with lots of little surprises. And then the next 68 years will whiz by. Yes! This is it! I glance over at Dan, who is chatting with Toby, oblivious of my thoughts. He looks a bit careworn, it occurs to me. He looks tired. He needs something to ginger him up, something to make him smile or even laugh, something out of the ordinary, something fun or romantic. What? It's too late to organize a stripogram, which, by the way, he'd hate. But can't I do something? Right now, something to shake us out of our malaise. I take another gulp of Chardonnay, and then the answer hits me. Oh, my God. Brilliant. Simple, but brilliant, as all the best plans are. I pull a piece of paper toward me and start to compose a little love poem. You may be surprised. Don't be. I want you, and I always will. Let's find a moment. Just be us. Just be the two of us. Just be. I pause, peering down at my sheet. I'm running out of steam. I always was a bit crap at poetry. How can I end it? Just be ourselves, I write finally. I draw a love heart and some kisses for good measure. Then I fold the whole thing up into a smallish oblong. Now to deliver it. I wait until Dan's looking the other way, then slip it into the pocket of his suit jacket, which is hanging on the back of his chair. He'll find it later, and he'll wonder what it is, and slowly unfold it. And at first, he won't understand, but then his heart will lift. Well, maybe it'll lift. Well, it would probably have lifted more if I was better at poetry, but so what? It's a thought that counts, isn't it? Have a toffee, says Toby, offering a bag to me. I made them myself. They're awesome. Thanks. I smile at him, take a toffee and put it in my mouth. A few moments later, I regret it. My teeth are locked together. I can't chew. I can't speak. My whole face feels immobilized. What is this stuff? Oh, they're quite chewy, says Toby, noticing me. They're called lock jaws. I shoot him a glare, which is supposed to mean, thanks for the heads up, not. Toby, says Tilda, crossly. You have to warn people about those things. Don't worry, she adds to me. It'll melt in about 10 minutes. 10 minutes? All right, people, says Dave, the quizmaster, tapping his microphone to get everyone's attention. His cheerful manner has somewhat faded over the course of the evening. In fact, he looks like he's desperate for it to end. Moving on. The next question was, how many actors have played Doctor Who? And the answer is 13. No, it's not, calls out a fattish guy in a purple polo shirt promptly. It's 44. Dave eyes him warily. It can't be, he says. That's too many. Doctor Who doesn't just feature in the BBC series, says the purple polo shirt guy pompously. It's 14, volunteers a girl at an adjoining table. There was an extra doctor, the war doctor, John Hurt. Right, says Dave, looking beleaguered. Well, that's not what I've got on my answer sheet. It's none of them, says Toby loudly. It's a trick question. Doctor Who isn't the name of the character. The name of the character is the Doctor. Boom. Kanani, he adds, looking pleased with himself. Booyah, in your face, everyone who wrote down a number. That's a common misunderstanding, says the man in the purple polo shirt, giving Toby a baleful look. The answer's 44, as I said. You want the full list? Did anyone put 13? Dave perseveres, but no one's paying attention. Who the hell are you, anyway? Retorts a man in a flowery shirt who is quite red in the face. He waves a belligerent hand at the purple polo shirt team. This is supposed to be a local friendly quiz, but you come marching in with your matching bloody shirts, picking fights. Oh, don't like strangers, do you? The purple polo shirt guy glowers at him. Well, sorry, Adolf. What did you call me? The man in the flowery shirt kicks back his chair and stands up, breathing hard. You heard. The purple polo shirt guy gets up too and takes a menacing step toward the flowery shirt man. I can't bear this, says Olivia. I'm going out for a cigarette. She reaches for Dan's jacket and puts it on, then looks at Simon's, which is almost identical, and back at the one she's wearing. Wait, Simon, is this your jacket? You're wearing Simon's, says Dan easily. We swap chairs. He prefers a lower back. It's about 5 seconds before the significance of this hits me. Simon's jacket. That's Simon's jacket. I put a love poem in Simon's jacket. Have you got a lighter? Olivia reaches in the pocket and pulls out my oblong of paper. What's this? She says, unfolding it. As she sees the love heart, her whole face blanches. No, no, I need to explain. I try to wrench my teeth apart to speak, but the stupid bloody toffee is too strong. I can't manage it. I wave my hands frantically at Olivia, but she's staring at my poem with a look of utter revulsion. Again, Simon, she says at last. What do you mean, again? Says Simon, who's watching the purple polo shirt guy and flowery shirt man trade insults. You promised. Olivia's voice is so scorching, I feel quite bowled over. You promised, Simon, never again! She brandishes the poem at Simon, and as he reads it, his face blanches too. I try to grab at the paper and get their attention, but Olivia doesn't even notice me. Her eyes are blazing and quite scary. I've never seen that before, Simon is stuttering. Olivia, you must believe me. I have no idea what, who. I think we all know who, Olivia says savagely. It's obvious from this piece of illiterate trash that it's your previous friend. I want you, and I always will, she declaims in a syrupy voice. Let's find a moment. Just be us. Did she get it from a Hallmark card? She's so mocking, my face flames bright red. At last, with a final wrench, I get my teeth apart and grab the paper from her hand. Actually, that's my poem, I say, trying to sound bright and nonchalant. It was meant for Dan. Wrong jacket, so it was. It's ours, Mine, not Simon's. You don't need to worry about... or anything, so... anyway... I finally managed to stop babbling and realize that everyone around the table is watching. Dumbstruck. The look of horror on Olivia's face is so priceless, I'd laugh if I didn't feel so totally embarrassed. So... here you are, Dan, I add awkwardly and give him the paper. You could read it now, or later. It's quite short. I add, in case he's expecting six verses and metaphors about war, or something. Dan doesn't look very thrilled to be handed a love poem, to be fair. He glances at it and clears his throat and shoves it in his pocket without reading it. I didn't mean... Olivia's hands are clenched harder than I've ever seen them. Sylvie, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to insult you. It's fine. Honestly. You're a disgrace to quizzes. The voice of the flowery-shirted man makes us all jump. You had that phone under the table all the time. We did not, the purple polo shirt man shouts back. That's fucking slander, that is. He pushes a table roughly toward the flowery-shirted man, and all the glasses jostle and chink together. Fight! 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 Calls out Toby, cheerfully. Be quiet, Toby, snaps Tilda. So, Dave is saying desperately into the microphone over the hubbub. Let's carry on. And the next question was, which Briton won an ice skating gold at the... He breaks off as the flowery-shirted guy charges at the purple polo shirt team. One of them tackles him, as though they're playing rugby, and the others start roaring encouragement. All around the pub, people start exclaiming and gasping. The Russian girl even shrieks as though someone stuck a knife into her. People, Dave is imploring. People, calm down, please. Oh, my God. They're fighting. They're actually punching one another. I've never even seen a pub brawl before. Sylvie, says Dan in my ear. Shall we go? Yes, I say at once. Yes. As we're walking home, Dan takes out my love poem. He reads it. He turns the page over as though expecting more. Then he reads it again. Then he puts it away. He looks touched and a bit flummoxed. Okay, maybe slightly more flummoxed than touched. Dan, listen, I say in a rush. I have this whole big explanation to give you. Of your poem? He looks at me questioningly. Yes, of course of my poem. What did he think I meant? Of thermocombustion? You don't need to explain it. I got it. It was nice, he adds after a moment's thought. Thank you. Not the poem itself, I say a bit impatiently. I mean, the concept of the poem. The fact of the poem. It's all part of my new brilliant idea which will solve everything. Right. He nods, then takes the poem out and looks at it again under the light of a street lamp, frowning slightly. Is there supposed to be a second verse? No, I say defensively. It's pithy. Ah, and it's only the beginning. Here's my idea, Dan. We need to surprise each other. It can be like our joint thing. We can call it, I think for a moment, Project Surprise Me. To my gratification, Dan looks surprised. Ha! It begins. I was hoping Dan would latch onto the idea straight away, but he's looking a bit uncertain. Right, he says. Why? To pass the endless weary decades, of course. Imagine our marriage is an epic movie. Well, no one gets bored in a movie, do they? Why? Because there are surprises round every corner. I fell asleep in Avatar, he says promptly. I mean an exciting movie, I explain. And anyway, you only fell asleep in the middle bit, and you were tired. We're at the front door by now, and Dan reaches for his key. Then, looking over my shoulder, his face changes to one of horror. Oh, God. Oh, my God. What's that? Sylvie, don't look. It's awful. What? I swing round, my heart tripping in fright. What is it? Surprise, says Dan, and pushes open the door. Not that kind of surprise, I say furiously. Not that kind. Honestly, he has completely missed the point. I meant nice surprises, not stupid wind-ups. The sitter we used tonight is called Beth, and we've never used her before. As we walk into the kitchen, she smiles cheerily, but I can't quite smile back. The whole place is littered with toys. It's toy carnage. I mean, we're not the tidiest family in the world, but I do like to be able to see some floor space in my house. Hi, Beth, I say faintly. Was everything okay? Yeah, great. She's already pulling on her jacket. They're sweet, your girls. They couldn't sleep, so I let them have a little play. We have fun. Right, I manage. So I see. There's Lego everywhere. Dolly's clothes everywhere. Sylvanian family's furniture everywhere. See you then, says Beth blithely, taking the money that Dan is proffering. Thanks. Right, see you. The words are barely out of my mouth before the front door has slammed behind her. Wow, I say, looking around. Let's leave it, says Dan. Get up early. Get the girls to help. No, I shake my head. Mornings are such a rush. I'd rather get at least some of it put away now. I sink to the ground and begin to gather a Sylvanian table and chairs. I set them up together and add tiny cereal packets. After a moment, Dan sighs and starts grabbing Lego bits, with the resigned air of a convict settling in for a day with the chain gang. How many hours of our lives, he begins. Don't. I put three teeny saucepans on a teeny cooker and pat them. I do rather love Sylvanian families. Then I sit back on my heels. I'm serious, I say. We each arrange little surprises for the other. Keep our marriage sparky. I wait for him to put the Lego tub back in the cupboard. What do you think? Are you up for it?
Up for what exactly?
He peers at me with his most scrumptious expression. I still don't know quite what I'm supposed to do. That's the point. There isn't any supposed. Just use your imagination. Play around. Have fun. I head over to Dan, put my arms around his neck, and smile up at him affectionately. Surprise me. Chapter 5. I'm actually quite excited. Dan said he couldn't launch straight into some program of surprises for me. He needed time to think first. So we've had a week of preparation time. It's been a bit like Christmas. I know he's up to something, because he's been on Google a lot. Meanwhile, I've been all over this project, all over it. I have a special notebook labelled Project Surprise Me. He's not going to know what's hit him. I'm gazing with satisfaction at my Surprise Me master plan page when Mrs. Kendrick's tread becomes audible on the stairs. I hastily shut my notebook, turn to the office computer, and resume typing out captions for the Fabulous Fans brochure. We'll print the brochure on creamy paper, and then write all the labels out by hand in blue-black fountain pen. Rollerballs are very much not a Mrs. Kendrick thing. 19th-century fan, hand-painted by Parisian artist, unattributed. Good morning, Mrs. Kendrick. I look up with a smile. Good morning, Sylvie. Mrs. Kendrick is wearing a pale blue suit, her cameo brooch, and her customary worried frown. Customary as of the evil nephew arriving, that is. Apparently he's staying with her at the moment, which explains why she looks so downtrodden. I expect he lectures her about modern working practices over the toast every morning. She gives the room her usual anxious, sweeping gaze as though to say, "Something's wrong here. I don't know what." Then she turns to me. "Sylvie," she says, "have you heard of Museum Selfie Day?" She utters the words with care, as though they're a foreign language. "Yes," I say warily, "I have." "Why?" "Oh, just that Robert mentioned it. He thinks we should participate." "Well," I shrug, "we could, but I'm not sure the patrons would really go for it. Do you? I think it's for a certain demographic. I think, to be honest, taking selfies might put some of our patrons off.
Ah, Mrs. Kendrick nods. Quite, quite, good point. Then she pauses, looking still more worried. Sylvie, may I ask you? She lowers her voice to a whisper. What is a selfie? I keep hearing this word everywhere, but I've never quite... And I couldn't ask Robert what it meant. Oh, God. I bite my lip at the thought of poor old Mrs. Kendrick having some long conversation about selfie day with no idea what a selfie is. It's a photo, I say kindly. Just a photo of yourself somewhere. You take it with your phone. I know this won't mean much to Mrs. Kendrick. In her world, a phone is something that lives on a side table and has a curly wire. She meanders out of the office, probably to go and look dolefully at the Tesco value biscuits we now offer, and I type another caption. Feathered fan. As I type, I feel a bit conflicted. Obviously, I still resent this Robert character for trampling into our world and freaking out his aunt. But on the more positive side, if he's suggesting we do museum selfie day, maybe he's not going to turn us into condos. Maybe he actually wants to help? Should we do museum selfie day? I try to imagine any of our regular patrons taking a selfie and fail. I can see where Robert's coming from. I really can, but hasn't he picked up the vibe? Hasn't he looked at our clientele? Even so, I write museum selfie day on a post-it and sigh. It's the kind of forward-thinking idea I would have been really excited about when I first joined Willoughby House. I actually wrote a whole digital strategy document when I arrived, in my spare time. I dug it out last night to see if there was anything useful in it, but when I read it through, all I could do was wince. It felt so old. It referred to websites that don't even exist anymore. Mrs. Kendrick, needless to say, responded to it at the time with a charming, "I don't think so, dear." So we didn't use any of my ideas. Willoughby House just went on its own sweet, quirky way. And we're fine. We're happy. Do we need to change? Isn't there room for one place in the world that isn't like everywhere else? With another sigh, I consult the typed notes, which one of Mrs. Kendrick's pet experts compiled for us. But he hasn't added anything about this fan. Honestly, is there nothing else to say about it? I'm not just putting feathered fan. It sounds totally lame. The V&A wouldn't just put feathered fan, I'm sure of it. I peer at the photo of the fan, which is large and rather flamboyant, then add, probably used by a courtesan, which I expect is true. Then my phone buzzes, and I see Tilda on the display. Hiya. I fit my phone under my ear and carry on typing. What's up? I have a hypothetical for you, says Tilda without preamble. Suppose Dan bought you a piece of clothing as a surprise and you didn't like it. At once my mind zigzags like lightning. Dan's bought me something. Tilda knows about it. How? Because he asked her advice, maybe. What's wrong with it? What could be wrong with it? What is it? No. I don't want to know. It's supposed to be a surprise. I'm not going to ruin his surprise. And anyway, I'm not the type of person to pick holes in a present just because it's not perfect, whatever that is. I'm not some kind of mean-spirited control freak. I love the idea that Dan has gone off to choose me something, and I'm sure it's wonderful, whatever it is. I'd appreciate it, whatever it was, I say a little sanctimoniously. I'd be really grateful he'd bought me something and value his effort and thought, because that's what presents are all about. It's not the things themselves which matter, but the emotions behind those things. I finish my sentence with a flourish, feeling rather noble for being so unmaterialistic. Okay, says Tilda, not sounding convinced. Fair enough, but suppose it was really expensive and really hideous. My fingers stop, midway through typing the word embroidered. How expensive? I say at length. How hideous. Well, I don't want to give anything away, says Tilda cautiously. It's supposed to be a surprise. Give a little bit away, I suggest, lowering my voice instinctively. I won't get on. Okay, Tilda lowers her voice too. Suppose it was cashmere, but a really odd colour? Again, my mind does lightning zigzags. Cashmere. Dan bought me cashmere. But, oh God, what colour? Tilda is actually quite adventurous with colour, so if she thinks it's bad... How do you know what colour it is? I can't help asking. Dan asked me to take delivery, and the box was already a bit open, so I peeked inside the tissue paper, and she exhales. I don't know for sure, but I don't think you're going to like it. What colour is it? Tilda sighs again. It's this weird petrol blue. It's horrible. Shall I send you the link? Yes. I wait anxiously for her email to arrive, click on the link, and then blink in horror. Oh, my God, I know, comes Tilda's voice. Awful. How do they even create that colour? I don't know. The sweater itself is quite nice, if a little dull in shape. But that blue... On the website, they've put it on this stunning Asian girl and given her blue lipstick to match, and she can carry it off. Just about. But me, with my pale skin and blonde hair... In that... They talked Dan into it, asserts Tilda. I'm sure they did. He told me they were very helpful on the phone. Like hell they were. They had a shedload of vile blue sweaters to sell, and along comes Dan like an innocent lamb with his credit card and... No idea... What am I going to do, Tilda? My voice jerks in slight panic. What am I going to do? I'm not feeling quite as noble as I was. I mean, I know it's the thought that counts and everything, but I really don't want an expensive petrol blue cashmere sweater in my wardrobe, reproaching me every time I don't wear it, or having to put it on every time we go out to dinner, or saying I love it, and then Dan buys me the matching scarf and gloves for Christmas, and I have to say I love those too. And then he gets me a coat and says, It's your colour, darling. Exchange it, suggests Tilda. Oh, but... I wince. I can't say, Dan, darling, that's amazing. It's perfect. Now I'm going to exchange it. Shall I say something to Dan? Would you? I collapse in relief. I'll say I caught sight of it, and I know the company, and there's something that would suit you much better. Just a friendly suggestion. Tilda, you're a star. So, what shall I suggest? Oh, dunno. I've never looked at this website before. I'm quite impressed, actually, that Dan headed there. It's not discount cashmere. It's posh, high-end, Scottish cashmere. I flick through a few of the pages and suddenly come across a cardigan called the Nancy. It's stunning. Long line and flattering, with a belt. It'll look fantastic over jeans. Hey, look at the Nancy cardigan, I say in excitement. Okay, just clicking. There's a pause, then Tilda exclaims, Oh, that's perfect. I'll tell Dan to order you that instead, not in vile blue. What colour do you like? I scroll down the colour options, feeling like a child in a sweetie shop. Choosing your own surprise present is fun. Sea foam, I say at last. Gorgeous. What size? I stare at the website uncertainly. Maybe 10? Maybe 12. What size is the sweater? It's size 10, reports Tilda, but it's a bit small looking. Tell you what, I'll get Dan to order both, and then I'll look at them and judge. He can send the other one back. I mean, if you're going to get it right, you might as well get it right. Tilda, thank you. Oh, it's no trouble. I'll call Dan now. It's quite fun, secret packages arriving like this. She hesitates, then adds, Very nice of Dan to order you a cashmere sweater out of the blue. Is it in honour of anything? I'm not sure how to reply. I haven't told anyone else about our little project, but maybe I'll confide in Tilda. Kind of, I say at last. I'll tell you when I see you. I'm not expecting to hear any more from Tilda that day, but 2 hours later, as I'm in the middle of typing out a newsletter, she rings again. They're here? What are here? I say, confused. Your cardigans. Dan changed the order. They biked them over and took the first sweater back. It's a good delivery service, I must say. Wow, well, what do you think? Gorgeous, says Tilda emphatically. My only issue is which size I can't tell, and so I was wondering, why don't you pop over quickly and try them on? Try them on? I stare uncertainly at the phone. Choosing my own surprise present was one thing, but is trying it on going too far? Shouldn't I keep some of the mystery? I say. Mystery? Tilda scoffs. There is no mystery. Try them on, choose the one that fits, job done. Otherwise, I'm bound to tell Dan the wrong size, and it'll be a great big hassle. She sounds so matter-of-fact, I'm convinced. Okay. I glance at my watch. It's time for lunch, anyway. I'm on my way. As I arrive at Tilda's house, I can hear thumping noises coming from upstairs. Tilda opens the front door, scoops me in for a hug, then yells, "What are you doing?" over her shoulder. A moment later, Toby appears on the stairs. He's in an old white T-shirt and black jeans and is holding a hammer. "Hello, Sylvie. How are you?" he says politely. Then he turns to Tilda before I have time to reply. "What do you mean? What are you doing? You know what I'm doing. We discussed it." I can see Tilda breathing in and out again slowly. "I mean," she says, "why are you making so much noise?" "I'm putting up speakers," says Toby, as though it's obvious.
"But why is it taking so long?"
"Mum, have you ever put up speakers?" Toby sounds irritated. "No, so this is how long it takes. This is what it sounds like. Bye, Sylvie, nice to see you," he adds in his polite Toby manner, and I can't help smiling. He turns and marches back upstairs, and Tilda glowers after him. "Don't damage the wall," she calls. "That's all I ask. Don't damage the wall." "I'm not going to damage the wall," Toby shouts back, as though highly offended. "Why would I damage the wall?"
There's the sound of a door shutting, and Tilda clutches her head. "Oh, God, Sylvie."
He has no idea what he's doing. He's got some set of power tools from somewhere.
"Don't worry," I say soothingly. "I'm sure it'll be fine."
"Yes," Tilda seems unconvinced. "Yes, maybe. Anyway," she focuses on me as though for the first time. "Cardigans." "Cardigans," I echo with a tweak of glee. I follow Tilda into her office, which is yellow-painted and lined with books and has French windows into the garden. She reaches below her desk and pulls out a flat, expensive-looking box.
"They're perfect," she says, as I'm taking off the lid. "The only issue is the fit."
I pull the cardigans out and sigh with pleasure. The color is beautiful, and the cashmere is super soft. How Dan could ever have chosen that vile... Anyway, not the point. An almighty whining drilling comes from upstairs, and Tilda jumps. "What's he doing now?" She gazes upward, as though in despair.
"It'll be fine," I say reassuringly. "He'll just be putting brackets up or something."
I try on the size 10, and then the size 12, and then the size 10 again, admiring myself in Tilda's full-length mirror. "Stunning." Tilda eyes me curiously. "But you still haven't told me what it's for. Not birthday, not Christmas, not your wedding anniversary, I don't think." "Oh," I pause in my preening. "I don't mind telling Tilda, I suppose, even though this is quite a private thing." "Well, the truth is, Dan and I have decided to plan some little surprises for each other."
"Really?"
Tilda's curious gaze doesn't waver.
"Why?"
I won't go into the whole 68 more years of marriage thing, I decide. It might sound a bit weird.
"Because why not?" I prevaricate.
"To keep our marriage alive. Spice things up. Because it's fun."
"Fun?"
Tilda looks aghast. "Surprises aren't fun."
"Yes, they are."
I can't help laughing at her expression.
"I understand. Keep your marriage alive. That I understand. But surprises, no."
She shakes her head emphatically. "Surprises have a bad habit of going wrong."
"They do not," I retort, feeling nettled. "Everyone loves surprises."
"Life throws enough curveballs at you. Why add to them?"
"This won't end well," she adds darkly, and I feel a flinch of annoyance.
"How can it not end well?" Look, just because you don't happen to like surprises, you're right, she nods. I don't like surprises.